Thanks for listening to this message from the life of St. Bees. We're a church that loves to empower, equip and inspire. And in order to better fulfill this call, we're currently undertaking an audacious church relocation project. Find out more, including how you can take part, at www.goandgrow.london. Thank you, and may this message better help you to live a life full of adventurous faith.
Few weeks, you'll know that in these weeks leading up to Easter, here in the evening service, we've been looking together at the events that took place in the last 24 hours of the life of Jesus before he was crucified on the cross, hence the title of the series, 24. There we go. It had to come.
Previously, I'm 24.
So that's your cue. Previously, on 24, what has happened so far? Let me remind you where we started. Colin kicked off the series by looking at the period from 9 o'clock in the morning until 9 o'clock in the evening. That was the first period of time that we looked at. If we can just have that up on the screen to show us that period of time, there we are. What happened in this first period of time? Colin, talk to us about it. What was it that took place? Again? The Last Supper, that's right. It was the Last Supper that Jesus had with his disciples. What type of meal do we think it was? Louder? A Passover meal, that's right. It was one of those meals that the Jews celebrated once a year where they remembered the time that God brought them safely out of Egypt. And in particular, they remembered the fact that when the angel of death passed through Egypt, he passed over the homes of the Israelites who had daubed blood on the door frames of their homes. And when Jesus celebrated this Passover meal as the Last Supper with his disciples, he gave them a whole new way of looking at what was happening. And he looked at the bread and the wine, and he used those familiar words to us, "This is my body, this is my blood." After that meal was over, at around 9 o'clock in the evening, they moved into the next period, which runs through from 9 o'clock until midnight. They left the room where they had been eating, and as Henry told us last week, they made their way across town to the Garden of Gethsemane, which is on the Mount of Olives. And last week, for the sake of those of us who have tidy and organized minds like the Lord himself, Henry looked at 4 points in the story that began with the letters A, B, C, and D. So this is your opportunity to encourage and affirm Henry by remembering what those letters stood for. So please, Henry's spirit is sensitive. Don't wound it by letting me down at this moment. So what were the 4 words that Henry told us that summed up what happened in the Garden of Gethsemane? The first word began with A. It was the word
agony.
That's right. Jesus prayed in great agony. What was the second word?
Betrayal.
What was the second word?
Bravery.
Jesus bravely faced his imminent death. Well done to those who took notes who are now referring to them. And then the C. What did that stand for?
Calm control.
Calm control. Jesus remained in calm control when they came to arrest him. And then finally, he suffered D, which was desertion, which is what you were thinking of when you said betrayal. So you were in the right order, in the right ballpark, but not quite the right word. The word desertion, he was deserted by all his disciples. And that's what we looked at last week. That's what's happened so far previously on 24. And today we take up the story after the arrest of Jesus. We're going to look at the period which runs from midnight through until 3 o'clock in the morning. And the account of what happened in this period is found in Matthew chapter 26, verses 57 to 68. If you've got a copy of the church Bible, you'll find that on page 943. If you haven't got a copy of the church Bible and would like one, you're already doing the right thing by raising your hand and one will be brought to you. So you can look that up. Matthew chapter 26, page 943. We're going to read together from verses 57 to 68. And Naomi is kindly going to come and read that for us. Thank you, Naomi.
Those who had arrested Jesus took him to Caiaphas, the high priest, where the teachers of the law and the elders had assembled. But Peter followed him at a distance, right up to the courtyard of the high priest. He entered and sat down with the guards to see the outcome. The chief priests and the whole Sanhedrin were looking for false evidence against Jesus so they could put him to death. But they did not find any, though many false witnesses came forward. Finally, two came forward and declared, "This fellow said, 'I am able to destroy the temple of God and rebuild it in 3 days.'" Then the high priest stood up and said to Jesus, "Are you not going to answer? What is this testimony that these men are bringing against you?" But Jesus remained silent. The high priest said to him, "I charge you under oath by the living God, tell us if you are the Messiah, the Son of God." "You have said so," Jesus replied, "but I say to all of you, from now on, you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven." Then the high priest tore his clothes and said, "He has spoken blasphemy. Why do we need any more witnesses? Look, now you have heard the blasphemy. What do you think?" "He is worthy of death," they answered. Then they spat in his face and struck him with their fists. Others slapped him and said, "Prophesy us to us, Messiah. You, who hit you?"
Thank you, Naomi. So if you were following the reading in the church Bible, you may have noticed that the passage is given the heading, "Jesus before the Sanhedrin." So what's the Sanhedrin? Well, at this time, the land of Judea, where Jesus was under Roman rule. But the Romans allowed the Jews to have their own ruling council. It was made up of 70 members, and it was made up of the chief priests, the teachers of the law, in other words, rabbis, and a number of the elders, the older wise men in the land. And together, these three groups made up the Sanhedrin, or the Jewish council. They usually met in a chamber that was inside the temple. You could have a diagram there of what we think that chamber looked like. And there in the bottom corner, a diagram of the temple showing you where in the temple it was. And under Roman supervision, the Sanhedrin was the highest political, legal, and religious authority in Judea. And so after his arrest in Gethsemane, Jesus is brought to trial before the Sanhedrin. One particular person is mentioned. We're told they took Jesus to Caiaphas, the high priest. And we know from other records that Caiaphas was actually one of the longest serving high priests that they'd had, serving from AD 18 to 36. So Jesus is now on trial before the Sanhedrin. And what happens next can really only be described as an absolute travesty of justice. This was not a fair trial. This was not an unbiased judge and jury objectively examining the facts. You see, the Sanhedrin's minds, the members of the Sanhedrin, they'd already made their minds up before ever Jesus came on trial before them. In fact, we know from the Gospels that they had made their minds up some time ago. If we read in another account in the Gospels, in John chapter 11, if you've got a Bible and you want to look at it, it's page 1018. There was an occasion where Jesus raised Lazarus from the dead. And then we are told what the reaction of the Sanhedrin was to Jesus doing such a thing. We read in John 11, "Then the chief priests and the Pharisees called a meeting of the Sanhedrin." "What are we accomplishing?" they asked. "Here is this man performing many signs. if we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him. And then the Romans will come and take away both our temple and our nation. Then one of them, named Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, spoke up. You know nothing at all. You do not realize that it is better for you that one man die for the people than that the whole nation perish. So from that day on, they plotted to take his life. So Jesus being brought before the Sanhedrin is, as we said, this absolute travesty of justice. They'd already met before this trial. They'd met some time ago when he raised Lazarus from the dead. They'd met on another occasion, we read in Matthew 26, verses 3 to 5, where again they'd reaffirmed their decision. Let's get rid of this man. They'd already met. They'd already made up their minds about Jesus. We need to get rid of him. And in fact, they'd not only made up their minds, they'd already been plotting to take his life. There was absolutely no chance of Jesus getting a fair trial when he was brought on trial before the Sanhedrin. But that's not all. We know that in the way they conducted this trial, they actually broke all their own laws. We have documents that exist from a slightly later period which set out the ways in which the Sanhedrin was supposed to operate. They're sort of operating procedures. And many scholars think that it's safe to assume that even though they're written down later, they reflect the practice at the time of Jesus. And one writer says that in this trial, they broke no less than 27 of their own rules. I haven't got time to tell you all 27. Let me give you a few examples. Their own rules said that the Sanhedrin was not supposed to meet anywhere other than the temple. They should not meet in the high priest's palace. But that's where they met. They had this sort of secret meeting, not in the public chamber where they were supposed to meet, but in a private place. The Sanhedrin's own rules said that trials were not supposed to take place on the eve of a Sabbath or on the eve of a festival day. And this was the Passover meal, so the day before Passover. They shouldn't have been meeting on that day. Their own rules said so. Their own rules said that any trial where there was the possibility that it might end in a death sentence should be conducted in the hours of daylight. And this took place, as we've already seen, between midnight and 3 o'clock in the morning. Hardly daylight hours. Their own rules said that no testimony was valid unless all witnesses agreed on all details. And Mark tells us in his account, many testified falsely against him, but their statements did not agree. And their own rules said that they were supposed to allow a day to pass from when they had considered a case until they passed a verdict, if that verdict was likely to be the death sentence, that they should allow a 24-hour period to reflect before they passed their verdict. But this was all rushed through in a matter of hours. They broke every single one of their own rules. Their own rules of procedure, how you conduct trials, were ignored and broken. And so we have the trial with a completely biased court who ignore all their own rules of procedure. If ever in human history there was a trial that was a travesty of justice, this was it. And how does Jesus react to the injustice of it all? How does Jesus respond when he's faced with a corrupt court, with illegal procedures and witnesses who blatantly lie about him? How does Jesus respond? Let's read it again. We read, then the high priest stood up and said to Jesus, are you not going to answer? What is this testimony that these men are bringing against you? And then Matthew records very simply, but Jesus remained silent. I wonder why. What do you think? Why don't you take a moment and just talk to one another and ask yourself that question. Why do you think Jesus remained silent? Faced with such injustice, why didn't he say something? Why did Jesus remain silent? And is there anything that we can learn from how Jesus behaved about how we might behave if we're treated unjustly? Okay, 2 or 3 minutes, talk to one another about those two questions. Why did Jesus remain silent, and what can we learn from Jesus remaining silent? So what have you come up with? One or two of you just feedback. Why do you think Jesus chose not to say anything? Why do you think he remained silent?
Fulfilling scripture.
Fulfilling scripture. Tell us more.
I think it's in Isaiah.
Yeah.
This is about, I can't remember. But yeah, it's from Isaiah. So I think also he was fulfilling that.
Yeah.
So there might have been one.
Fulfilling prophecy, absolutely right. Isaiah 53 says that he opened not his mouth, that there was fulfilling of prophecy there. Great answer. Any other reason? Ruth?
He didn't really need to justify.
He didn't need to justify himself. He didn't feel the need to justify himself. That's interesting, isn't it? Are we like that? Do we feel the need sometimes maybe to justify ourselves? Any other reasons why Jesus might have remained silent? His silence was a judgment on the court. That's right. Interesting, isn't it? By not saying anything, he was actually almost passing judgment on their mark. He was saying, it may well be absolutely that. Knowing what was coming, he was conserving some of his energy. Anything else?
He resigned himself to God's will. He knew what was going to happen. So what's the point?
He knew exactly what was going to happen. He was accepting God's will. There's an interesting passage in 1 Peter that says this. When they hurled their insults at him, he did not retaliate. When he suffered, he made no threats. Instead, he entrusted himself to him who judges justly. Interesting that, isn't it? When faced with injustice, he didn't fight it. He didn't come against it with fighting and arguments. He chose instead to entrust his case to God who judges justly. So what about the second question? Is there anything we can learn about how we might react when we're treated unjustly? What did you come up with on that? Did you come up with anything on that one? Was that just, oh, that's a bit difficult, isn't it? Sorry?
Not to feel the need to have to explain yourself.
That's right. Not to feel the need to have to explain yourself all the time. It's an interesting, isn't it, that as Christians, we're often passionate about justice, and that's absolutely right. I think to be passionate about justice for other people, to want to see justice for others, is something that should be the hallmark of Christians. But sometimes when it's ourselves, we feel the need to justify ourselves, but Jesus didn't. We saw that, and the bit that I didn't read you in 1 Peter says this, "To this you were called, because Christ suffered for you, leaving you an example that you should follow in his steps." When they hurled their insults at him, he did not retaliate. In other words, that was an example to us. The way Jesus reacts and responds when facing injustice against himself is an example to us, said Peter. So faced with a corrupt and a biased court, illegal procedures, and witnesses who blatantly lie about him, Jesus is silent. And so faced with a silent Jesus, the high priest tries another tactic, and he demands that Jesus reply. He uses a particular form of words that were used in legal proceedings to try and make a person cooperate. It's a little bit like a judge today saying to someone, "And may I remind you that you are under oath?" So it's reminding them of their responsibility to answer honestly. And so the high priest asks the question that goes right to the heart of the matter. We'll look at it in a moment, but let's just come at it from a slightly different angle for a moment. See, over the years that I've been around, and they are many, as Colin regularly reminds me, over the years I've met a number of people who've said things like this. "I think Jesus was a great teacher, but I can't accept that he was anything other than just a human being who was a great teacher." People have said things like that. Or I was meeting with someone just 2 or 3 months ago who said to me, "Jesus never claimed to be divine. Jesus never claimed that he was God. That's something that other people have said about him. He never said it himself." So let's look very carefully at what is happening in this interaction between Jesus and the high priest. Three things that we want to look at very carefully. We want to look very carefully at what did the high priest ask? What did Jesus say in reply? And how did the high priest understand that? So let's look at the first. What did the high priest ask? Well, it's the second part of verse 63. The high priest says, "Tell us if you are the Messiah, the Son of God." In other words, the high priest is cutting right through all the other issues and getting right to the heart of the matter. Enough of the little details. Did Jesus break the Sabbath? Did Jesus threaten to tear down the temple? Let's forget those things. Let's get right to the heart of the matter. And this is the question. Are you claiming to be the Messiah? Are you saying that you are this anointed servant of God that we have been waiting for so many years? Are you claiming to be the Messiah? Are you claiming that you are the Son of God? I need to be careful not to read too much into that statement about the Son of God. A lot of people think that's just another word for talking about the Messiah. Jewish people expected the Messiah to have that same special relationship with God that the kings of Israel had had in the past, who were also referred to as the Son of God. So it doesn't necessarily mean that the high priest was asking, "Are you claiming to be God?" But he was certainly asking Jesus, "Are you the Messiah? Are you claiming to be the one we've been waiting for? Are you claiming to have a special relationship with God?" Right to the heart of the matter. So let's look at the second thing on the list. What exactly did Jesus say? Well, you find that in verse 64. "You have said so," Jesus replied. And that first phrase doesn't sort of sound like a very clear answer, does it really? It's almost as if, Jesus is saying, "Your word's not mine." Well, that's not really very helpful, because that's not really what we're wanting from Jesus. But it's helpful to be able to compare the different gospel accounts. And Mark's account in his gospel is very clear. In Mark chapter 14, Mark's account says this: "The high priest asked him, 'Are you the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed One?' 'I am,' said Jesus." That's much clearer. There's no ambiguity there, is there? Now, what's significant about that answer? That's a real question. You are allowed to answer. What is significant about Jesus saying, "I am"? It was the name of God himself. You remember when God revealed himself in the Old Testament to Moses, and Moses said to God, "If I'm going to go back and do what you ask me to do," and they ask, "Who sent me? What's your name? What shall I tell them?" And God said, "Tell them, 'I am has sent me, has sent you to them.'" So this is the name of God himself. It's the divine name. And so Jesus is actually making something of a claim here. When he says, "I am," you can almost hear it in the room, because he is taking in that statement the name of God himself. And then he follows it with another big statement, because he says, "You've said so, but I say to all of you, from now on you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven." What's that all about? Well, what Jesus is doing there is he's picking up and quoting an Old Testament prophecy in the book of Daniel. If you want to prove that I'm telling you the truth, look at page 847 of the Church Bibles, Daniel chapter 7. Daniel records a vision and he says, "In my vision at night I looked, and there before me was one like a son of man coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence. He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All peoples and nations of every language worshipped him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and his kingdom is one that will not be destroyed." Now the high priest and every other member of the Sanhedrin would have recognized immediately that Jesus was quoting from Daniel chapter 7. And so many things have been written about the Son of Man in Daniel that if I tried to explain all of that, we would be here, not just all evening, but all week. But there's just one point that we need to see in what Daniel, in that passage from Daniel, and it's this. This character who is spoken about in Daniel, whom Jesus is saying, "And this is me," it says about him this: all nations and people of every language worshipped him. So let's be absolutely clear. In the Bible, whether it's the Old Testament or the New Testament, the only person who is ever worshipped is God. You see, there are times in the Bible where people make the mistake of trying to worship either a human being or an angel. And you find when that happens, they're always corrected by either the person or the angel, and they're told, "No, don't worship me, don't bow down in front of me, don't worship me, worship God." And so when you get a statement like this that says that he was worshipped, it's saying this character, whoever he turns out to be, whatever else we may say about him, this one like a son of man coming on the clouds of heaven is God to be worshipped. And so when Jesus quotes this passage, I don't think there's any doubt whatsoever. He's not only answering the high priest's question, "Are you the Messiah?" and saying, "Yes, I am." He's also saying, "And I'm the fulfillment of this prophecy in Daniel. I am that person who is going to be worshipped." He was claiming to be God. So let's look quickly at the third issue. How did the high priest understand what Jesus said? Well, it's very obvious. In verse 65, the high priest tore his clothes and said, "He's spoken blasphemy. Why do we need to hear any more?" There's absolutely no doubt that the high priest had understood exactly what Jesus was saying. Jesus was claiming to be God. And the high priest had to respond to that in some way. So do we. C.S. Lewis, the man who wrote the Chronicles of Narnia, wrote lots of other books as well. He wrote one book called Mere Christianity. It's a classic book written a long time ago, but still well worth a read. And he says this in this book, Mere Christianity. The language is a little bit dated because it was from a time probably even before I was alive. So it's really very old. He says this: "I'm trying here to prevent anyone saying the really foolish thing that people often say about him," that is about Jesus. People say, "I'm ready to accept Jesus as a great moral teacher, but I don't accept his claim to be God." That is the one thing we must not say. A man who was merely a man and said the sort of things Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. He would either be a lunatic on the level with the man who says he is a poached egg, or else he would be the devil of hell. You must make your choice. Now, that's that last phrase that is the key one, isn't it? You must make your choice. I think it's absolutely clear that Jesus claimed to be God. I don't think we can argue with that. Jesus claimed and claims to be God. So he's either mad, and there have been people down through the years who've claimed to be divine, and many of them have been treated in our mental hospitals, because when you claim to be God, it is often taken as a symbol of your being mentally unwell. So was Jesus mad? Was he somehow mentally unstable? Was he just another one of the long stream of people who've claimed to be God but was really just mentally unwell? Or is he bad? Is he deliberately setting out for some evil motive to say something that isn't true? Is he lying to us? Or is he God? Is he telling the truth that he is the Son of God? That he is divine? That he's not just someone for us to admire and someone for us to respect, but he's someone to worship? As C.S. Lewis said, we have to choose. Caiaphas had to choose, and he chose the answer, bad. He said, it's blasphemy. He's saying something that is not true. He is lying. He is claiming to be God, and he can't possibly be God, so he is bad. He is lying. He is blaspheming. And with that, Jesus' trial before the Sanhedrin is over. And the rest of the members of the Sanhedrin are given a question by Caiaphas, where he says to them, what do you think? And with one voice, they say what they thought before the trial began. He's worthy of death. And in that moment, passed the death sentence on Jesus. And that's where this episode ends. We'll pick it up again next week where the story picks up. But that's this episode of 24. A biased court, an illegal trial, and an undeserved death sentence. When we look at the story, when we read this account, and when we hear about this travesty of justice, it's actually not just a historical account that we read without it affecting us, because there's a sense in which we're invited to put ourselves into the picture. We're invited to be part of the trial. We're invited to pass our own verdict. Jesus claims to be God. And we're invited to pass a verdict. I guess many of us have already done that. C.S. Lewis was someone who had done that. He said this towards the end of that passage that I quoted from Mere Christianity. He says this, now it seems to me obvious that he, that is Jesus, was neither a lunatic, he wasn't mad, nor a fiend, he wasn't bad. And consequently, however strange or terrifying or unlikely it may seem, I have to accept the view that he was and is God. That was the conclusion that C.S. Lewis came to. It's the conclusion that I've come to. It's the conclusion that I know many of you, maybe most of you, have come to. But I just wonder whether this evening there may be some for whom, to use the legal language, the jury is still out. The verdict hasn't yet been passed. You've heard the claim of Jesus this evening to be God, the Son of God, God in human flesh. So if you haven't ever made your mind up, if you haven't ever passed your verdict, what's it going to be? Was he mad, bad, or God? I'm going to invite the band back up, and we're just going to pray together.